24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. It's Monday the 28th. I hope you had a great weekend, had a little fun, got a little work done, all of that stuff. And I hope you're ready for a great week now. I have a fantastic show for you, and we're going to do some commentary. Before that, I'm going to go on one of my stupid rants. So be careful for that. You don't want to trip over it and hurt yourself. But anyway, first up today, we have Kevin Wade. He has written his first novel, longtime Hollywood heavyweight. You know some of the shows that he has been involved with. Most recently, he was part of the Tom Selleck show that ran for 12 years, I think. He has written this book. It's his first. We're going to ask him so many questions. How did you get started, and what did you do first, and what was your method? All of this is for you, first-time authors out there. I am doing this interview for you. If you're not writing a book yet, I want you to start. If you don't know how to start, the questions and answers of this interview will pertain to that. It will help you with that. And so I want you to write a book. Whatever you are the most knowledgeable on, write about that. If you want to write a fiction, made-up story, go crazy. The more crazy the stories, the better. But as an entrepreneur, it's just so critical that we expand and push our careers into written word, because either we need to use that as a calling card or as something to augment our sales process, whatever, it's a great thing. And so Kevin Wade is going to help us with that. After that, we have my favorite Canadian, Wayne Elliott, is with us. He, unbelievable career, started off at 14, 12 in the ship breaking business. You buy a ship and you tear it apart with your raw hands and you sell the scrap metal. And when I say ships, aircraft carriers, submarines, things like that, that he was buying on spec and then busting them up in his yard, and incredibly environmentally conscious. And so that we talk about that. He's been on the show a lot of times. And so we talk about that in other interviews, but he is so much preferable to all of the alternatives. The alternatives are the ship rusts at the bottom of the ocean, all the chemicals leak out and kill a bunch of stuff. That's really the only alternative. And so he had amazing success in that industry, and along the way figured out battery recycling. Yeah, you heard that right. And so he has just sold that recently to BlackRock, I believe. And today we're going to talk about stress and the Canadian tariff situation vis-a-vis the United States, and what all his Canadian friends are saying about us Americans. So a check-in on that. Segueing into what I want to rant about, Wayne and I are writing a book about environmental capitalism, the idea that so many environmentalists are great capitalists, and that's why they're going to be successful. And it is bashing all of the famous people, all of these celebrities that talk a lot and do nothing, and these academics who talk a lot and do worse, spread dumb ideas. Now, of course, some of the academics are right. We are not arguing in this book that global change and climate change is not happening, nor are we opposing the fact that humans are a big part of the problem. What we're saying is that entrepreneurs are going to solve the problem. That's it. Entrepreneurs are going to make the world a safe place. And I don't worry about environmental change anymore because I trust the entrepreneurs that I have met in this book. Many of them were on this show and how I got to know them. So we're out there talking to publishers, and there's a publishing genre that is sort of hybrid. It's you know, there's self-publishing, there's publishing with a big company, right? McGraw-Hill or somebody like that. And there's all sorts of models in between, hybrid models. One of the ones that had impressed me the most was what they were doing with Forbes and South by Southwest and Entrepreneur. Those three entities have been pulled in together by a previous guest here on the show, of course, and they're now doing the ghostwriting and using those incredible brands and things like that. I just wanted to let you know that that's not really an option anymore. So don't, I've been talking about it. I was going to use it myself. Their prices have gone so far out of what I think is fair that we're not going to be promoting them anymore. And so that means self-published. And I'm going to start doing some extra shows on it to help you and figure out how to get you there. I've done it twice. You can do it too. All right, we're going to get right started with Kevin in just a second. We are back in again. Thank you so much for being with us. You know, I think all of you should be writing a book. It is what us entrepreneurs do. We get good at something and then we teach others how to do it. To that end, I'm excited for you to meet our next guest. He didn't write a nonfiction like most of us should. He wrote some fiction, but the process will be helpful for us to learn. Please welcome Kevin Wade to the show. He is the showrunner. I think that means the boss of Blue Bloods, starring Tom Selleck. He's been doing that for over a decade. He is also the writer of Made in Manhattan, Working Girl, Meet Joe Black, a bunch of other famous movies that you've heard of. But the pandemic came and he found himself with a lot of time. And so he wrote his first book of fiction called Johnny Careless. Kevin, welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm good, Jim. Thanks for having me. Nice to be with you.
So is the showrunner the boss?
The showrunner is, it's a funny, it's a made up term. There is no contract that is put before someone and says, sign here and you're the showrunner. He's essentially the head writer. Runs the writer's room or the writing staff in the case of Blue Bloods and kind of serves as the diplomat ambassador department to the cast. So, you know, a script goes to the cast. Some of them may have ideas. Some of them may have complaints. And he's the guy that's the envoy between the writers and the actors. Beyond that, you get involved in editing, casting, a little bit of budget, a lot of politics with the studio, chief cook and bottle washer.
But there's also a director and a producer.
There is a director, there's a line producer, there's a whole bunch of departments from hair, makeup, wardrobe, casting, locations, all of it. And you have the showrunner has a hand in all of that. But again, your main job is to be the head writer, to help to generate stories, to edit them, and most importantly, to make sure it's something that can be on, in our case, Friday night at 10 o'clock.
And when they give out awards, is there an award for showrunner? I don't think
so. No, there's really no such thing. There's the showrunners. You can tell the person is the showrunner because the last credit in the crawl as the show ends will say executive producer and then somebody's name. And that somebody is usually what the press calls the showrunner. And it became kind of the coin of the realm for the guy who's the boss on a TV show.
And how is Tom Selleck to work with?
He was terrific. I've known him a long time. I was the last man in on a movie back in the 90s called Mr. Baseball, and we spent about a month together in Japan. He's a absolute professional, a wonderful actor, and just a guy who comes to work, has some fun at work, but he's a workhorse.
You said something in the past tense. Is the show not out there?
The show wrapped up its 14 seasons filming in June of last year, and the last episode aired in mid-December of last year.
Okay, I didn't know that they had written him off. Was it a good ending? Did they have the show is judged now a lot on the last episode.
Well, I'd have to leave that up to the viewers, but it seemed to be very well received and it was very highly rated. And I think we went out with a bang and always
What happened? What was the finale? What wrapped it all up?
It was a couple of gangs in New York decided to join forces, and they made some assassinations and attempted assassinations their calling card, and it fell on the Reagans, as it does in the best episodes of that show, to use their individual toolboxes alone and together to effectively end the war.
Where can we watch it now? Which platform is it available on?
I expect it's on Paramount Plus, the streaming arm of Viacom, Paramount, CBS.
Right. Okay. Did the writer's strike and the pandemic change Hollywood?
Yes, certainly looking in the rearview mirror, the pandemic shut everything down, depending on which show you were on. For us, it was a solid 6 months. For others, it was considerably longer than that. And then on the heels of that, we all had a good year and everything came roaring back. And then the writers and actors went on strike for about 6 months. So the business has shrunk. I won't go in and become the business pages here, but estimates are down, that it's down anywhere between 30% and 40% from where it was when we came back after the pandemic was called over.
Right. Well, I like movies and I like Hollywood to be good,
Yep.
Is Hollywood doing a good job these days of delivering quality movies to us?
That's a hard question to answer because I think it depends completely on which audience you are. For me, I'm older. I've been going to the movies since the late 1950s, to be honest with you. There's some stuff that's still wonderful. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff that is what they call IP, intellectual property, which means Marvel universes and reboots of animated movies or sequels to animated movies and sequels to everything, franchises. So there seems to be a lot of complaints about the dearth of original work, but then people come out with original work and people don't show up in the numbers they need them for. So I think it's kind of at a crossroads.
All right. Johnny Careless, tell us about it.
I had set out when I was in my 20s to be a crime, like a paperback novelist. I got blessedly waylaid with employment, first as a playwright, then as a screenwriter, and then as a running Blue Bloods for 14 years. And during the writer's strike, I was still on very much a high-pressured network deadline kind of habit, and there was no deadline habit to meet. We were on strike, so I sat down and started a paperback novel. I'm calling it that because it should be a fast, thrilling, entertaining, easy read. And it took me about 3-4 months, and I came up with Johnny Careless, which is it's about a guy who grows up in a small town on the North Shore of Long Island amidst some very wealthy towns and goes off to New York into the NYPD to follow in his dad's footsteps and bounces back to the area where he grew up as a, he's now the local police chief. And on page 2, the body of his best friend from childhood washes up dead on a beach. And our hero, whose name is Jeep Mullane, unlike everybody else who's looking at the corpse, thinks, I don't think it was a boating accident. I think something else happened here. And the story becomes about how he, both in the past, it's told in the past, and we watch these two young men grow into adult friends, but most importantly, he kind of has to figure out the tribal customs and codes and habits of the wealthy enclave where his friend grew up and how to figure out how to open the closets where the skeletons are hiding.
It's interesting. I love it. I love a good crime thriller. Is there anyone you want yourself, you want to be compared to? Do you like that? Or does that make
you mad? I want to be compared to anybody who the reader who bought the book likes my book and goes, it reminds me of so-and-so. So no, nobody in particular.
All right. I guess that's good. Almost 300 five-star reviews, Kevin. Incredibly impressive. I do know that fiction gets a lot more reads than nonfiction, but still, that's a lot. What'd you do to market it and get it promoted and published? Did you self, who published it? Walk us through that process.
Okay. I had an old friend, and sort of colleague, named Esther Newberg, who is a legendary literary agent, and I'd never written a book before. So we'd never had any business together. I showed her the first few chapters. She sent it to a wonderful woman named Deb Futter at Celadon, which is an imprint of Macmillan, the large, you know, huge, publishing house, and they agreed to publish it. In terms of marketing, boy, as a first-time novelist, you've got a lot of competition, most of it way better known in the marketplace and by readerships than you are, almost by definition. So there's a combination of advertising and marketing that the publishing house does, and this has been a very steep learning curve. There's also a responsibility of the author. I suppose it's certainly true for someone who self-publishes, but even for I was paid in advance and my book was published in all the formats, but it becomes a social media personal appearance. It's a very retail business. You know, you may find yourself going to a book signing and signing a dozen books, but that's the job. And you're happy to be there.
How many interviews and events have you done to publicize? Let people, how much hard work has it been?
I guess I've done at least a couple of dozen, maybe 30 combinations of bookstore signings and, Q&As in front of an audience, a lot of radio, some television, some simply written for whether it's, Poison Pen or Crime Reads or any number of things. I enjoy it. I enjoyed writing the book. I think if I weren't me, I would enjoy reading the book. And so I'm happy to get out there and share it and promote it. I'm proud enough of it, and I'm happy to kind of share it with people. Say it might be a good idea to pick this up. You'll enjoy it.
What is your writing process? How do you actually sit down and get pages with black ink in the appropriate places?
I go to a room, I close the door, it's just me in there, I boot up the computer, and I sit there and make stuff up. I think describing a writer's day is kind of like describing an institutionalized person's day. You sit in a room and you make stuff up. I've been doing it since I was 25 in terms of something that I was doing that someone was waiting for and paying for. So I don't want to say disciplined, but I'm used to it. So that's really it. 4 or 5 hours a day is usually the most you're going to get that's any good. Writing Johnny Careless was it was a difficult process because the learning curve was huge, but the customary 6 or 7 days a week, 4 hours a day, was something I've been doing for a long time.
All right. What happens when you get a block and there's nothing there?
There's a great old thing, Billy Wilder, the wonderful writer director back in the day of Some Like It Hot and Double Indemnity and a dozen of Sunset Boulevard movies you've loved all across the genres. And Billy Wilder's answer to that was, if you can't find out a way or a reason to have someone come in the door, have them come in the bathroom window. So it's a shorthand way of saying if you're blocked, your thinking is either too linear or you've just kind of hit a wall. Just you got to keep the story going. What happens if the guy breaks in instead of knocks? So there's a lot of that goes on.
All right. And then the marketing, have you had to arrange any of that yourself, or has the publisher arranged all of it?
No, the publisher and the publicist arranged all of it. There is a, I think there's a multi-tiered system where you send a new book out into the marketplace. Obviously, if I was Dennis Lehane or Michael Connelly or Carl Hyacin, there's a level of talk shows and things that you're going to go on. For me as a new writer, it was done fairly retail, but it was bookstore signings and lectures and Q&As and a lot of podcasts and radio shows and a few television shows, as I say. But there's a machinery in place for that, as there is for putting any entertainment product out into the marketplace and trying to get the word out.
All right.
That said, I didn't do it myself, but I think if I were to call up Macmillan and say, could you send over a couple of hundred copies, I'll put them in the trunk of my car and go door to door, they may well go, hey, that's a pretty good idea. You know, so it is, I can't emphasize enough how enormously entertainingly retail it is. As a new author, you are a door to door salesman.
You know, my first book was with McGraw-Hill, and I found the exact opposite. I'd call up and say, I need three books for people who said they want to do a review, and they would say no.
I hope their marketing guys have found another line of work, or maybe it was not in 2025, but in 2025 it seems to me it's you gotta get it out there like piecework.
Yep. What's the craziest thing you've done to promote?
I did do an opening of a chain bookstore a few weeks ago that I got there. It was the first day. It was a famous chain bookstore, and it's the first day it was open in this new, rather cavernous, accommodating but cavernous location. And they had a little desk set up and nothing else. There was a pile of books and a pen on a table. And I was, candidly, both the organ grinder and the organ grinder's monkey for about 5 hours. And I had fun with it, but I was hawking my wares.
All right. How do you break into Hollywood? Tell us that. How did you get into Hollywood in the first place?
I had written a play when I was 25 that was in a little 99-seat theater, but there was a pretty famous actress at the time, a wonderful woman named Brooke Adams was in it, so the first string critics came down, and they liked her, and they liked the play, and the audiences liked the play, so it moved to a bigger house and ran for a couple of years in New York, which meant that there's some people from Hollywood who came knocking on the door and said, you can write dialogue and characters. Would you like to write a movie? So I said, absolutely. And the first movie I wrote was called Working Girl with Harrison Ford and Melanie Griffith and Sigourney Weaver. Thank you. And
why did she clean the house topless, though?
Entertainment value, I guess.
Did someone tell you to do that to make sales?
I think that was an idea of the brilliant Mike Nichols, just to wake the audience up before the last 20 minutes of the movie started.
That got some slack, didn't it?
It got a little bit of flack, but, you know, it was a risk he took, we took, and it's part of the whole. You know, I do it to my great surprise and happiness. Sometimes the movie is still talked about or referred to today. And it was 1988 when it came out, so it's a long time ago. Whatever it is Mike did is still working for people.
Yeah, I mean, that movie does get talked about every once in a while.
But the break into Hollywood part is pretty, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of people seemingly born every day who want to break into Hollywood. And the only way to do it is, if you're a writer, to write something that is really good, because if you do, it will rise to the top. It will get on that pile that gets read. I know that's a very general way to put it, but I can't think of it another way. Write something really good that is just your own.
It seems the industry right now is kind of lost, that they don't know what to do. That maybe they've gone too DEI with Snow White and are having to undo a little bit of that. What do you think about the macro level of the industry right now?
Well, that stuff I don't really follow, but the delivery system has changed enormously in the last number of years. If you just take 2019 to today in 2025, streaming began, the theaters started to lose audiences, and then the pandemic hit and the theaters were closed down for a couple of years. And people started to watch at home. They bought if they were able to, they bought a bigger, flatter screen TV, and they got used to watching movies and long form television in the privacy of their own home. So the audience you were making this stuff for changed from being a mass audience in a big theater to a balkanized audience watching at home, more or less.
What's next for you?
Another one of these books. I'm writing a sequel to Johnny Careless called Pirate Jenny. I'll finish it in a couple of months and hopefully it'll be out next year.
Fantastic. And then you think that'll be your full-time gig? You think you're going to be able to make it as a full-time writer for your own works of fiction?
As a full-time writer, as long as someone wants to publish it and they publish it and some people buy it, it would be, I can't imagine a better job at this point in my life. Very happy to do that.
Fantastic. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us and congratulations. I hope the book continues to sell well.
Thank you, man. It's a pleasure to be with you. I appreciate the invitation too.
Our pleasure. And we will be right back. We are back with our good old friend, Wayne Elliott. Absolutely one of the top Canadian entrepreneurs out there. Several amazing businesses. And Wayne, we haven't spoken in a while. Welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Thanks. Always great to be with you, Jim.
How have things been going? I know you've been on the road down in Texas selling. I love that you actually get out there and sell. How was your trip?
It was good. That's a long drive I want you to go from my door. It was three long days each way. You know, I don't like to fly. If I can drive, I do. And so that was, you know, that was that extra long day. But anyway, I manage that stuff okay. But it's something that I wanted to mention today to folks in business, traveling salesmen, salespeople. Anybody that does any travel for their business or even, you know, for pleasure. It's just that, you know, we usually go on a vacation for a week or two. But, you know, I noticed on this trip, Jim, and my friend that I do a lot of webinars and radio with, Dr. Darko, he pointed out some of these things as well. I got that pneumonia came back on me on the drive back home after it was the 17th day, and since I left home. And you know, when you think about all the stresses that we really don't usually think about, for example, you're sitting in the car for 3 days, three long days. That's not the best for your back, and of course you've got to be on the ball. You're out there on the dangerous highways. So that was one. Eating out 100% of the time, meals. So on the drives there and back, we oftentimes would pull in somewhere at 9 o'clock at night, and what you're left with is a choice is fast food of some kind, and you know, whether it's pizza or hamburgers or whatever. And the same thing in the morning. We were going at 5:30 or 6 in the morning for breakfast, and It's amazing, Jim, the salt that's put into our foods today. And of course, it's in all the processed foods and the cold cuts and canned soups and so forth. It's the preservative. So, and they use a lot. If you look at vegetable juice or tomato juice today, for example, the range of salt goes from a low of 20% to a high, I saw, of 28%. So if you picture 1 quart of vegetable juice, if you drank that, you're drinking 1 full glass, 8 ounces of salt. Hard to believe. I mean, you know, it's hard to believe it tastes so good with that much salt. Between the salt and the sugar that's in dressings and in this and that, and of course all breads and baked goods are basically sugar. So there's the eating out while you're away, and you know, some of that's enjoyable, but you must realize that you're likely taking in just a ton more salt than is good for you. They said years ago, Health Canada did, that one small patty, they actually named the chain, it's the biggest chain for hamburgers, that one small patty had more sodium than a human can tolerate in a day. Now, I don't want to tell you the number of times I've ate 4 and 5 of those nasty little cheeseburgers in my life on a trip to one yard or the other. I seem to always be in the car. So, you know, we're getting a lot of salt and probably extra sugar when we're eating out like that. Then you stay in a hotel or motel, and for some people that's enjoyable. And if you don't do it often, it can be. If you do it a fair bit, you're not in your bed. It isn't your pillow, unless you carry your pillow. And every time I do, I lose it and leave it there. So you're in a different bed. And all of these little things that are really not little things, they all add up to some kind of stress. And it affects our immune systems. So we're more susceptible, Jim, the more stresses we put on ourselves. And there's a million stresses in this world, family, you name it, money. People have all kinds of health, all kinds of things to stress over. But it does, it's that old fight or flight. And unfortunately, our immune system does the same thing, Jim, when stressed. It either fights, if you're a fighter, or the thing that is stressing you the most about, you choose to fight over. But most people flee. So does our immune system. So that's why when they talk about stress kills, it's true. It's one of the worst things for us. And one of the hardest things to avoid, Jim. But I just wanted to point that out today, just for people's awareness and consciousness. I used to, when I traveled even more, I made this homemade salad dressing that I loved, with lots of fresh garlic, 4 or 5 types of onions, the oil and vinegar. And I would carry that in those Ziploc containers. And when I ordered a salad, I put my own dressing on it. And so I knew I was getting that good food. And, you know, if people can really avoid all the breads, boy, that's a big key to both helping maintain your weight and not getting sick around the middle with this genetically modified wheat. And there's just nothing. If you leave, I don't want to mention the brand name, but if you leave white bread out, ants won't even eat it. You know, insects won't even eat it. So there's nothing there for us that's any good. And just have a consciousness about it, an awareness, you know, can help us reduce the quantity of these kinds of things. I love hamburgers, cheeseburgers. I love them. And so what I do a lot of the time is I won't have the bun. I'll have the hamburger patty as my meat with supper, and I won't have the bun. So, you know, every little bit helps too, Jim. Soda pop, you know, with all the sugar is just so bad. And yet, I think Coke sells 1.9, I heard Warren Buffett the other day, 1.9 billion servings a day, 16 teaspoons of sugar in each can of Coke. The other flavors are, apparently Mountain Dew is the worst, one of my old favorites. But, you know, if we can stay away from that stuff, Jim, we're just a lot better off in the end. And then there's things like exercise, and sometimes you know, you, people can't get out for exercise. The winter's tough, or the health, injuries and so forth. It all plays a part of supporting our immune system. And I just find to have a conscience about it sure helps, as opposed to when I filled up with gas in the old days, I'll bet you of thousands of fill-ups, I didn't miss a chocolate bar or two many times at the counter. And so now this conscience, I have this little argument with myself as I look over the chocolate bars. And now 90% of the time, at least, I don't buy one. So it's things like that that ends up being important to us, Jim.
Very, very true. Very true. Can I switch topics, Wayne?
Absolutely.
So how much do you hate us Americans now? What's the sentiment in Canada about Trump and the tariffs and just all of this crazy stuff going on at the macro level?
It's very bad. Now, what do I think? I love Americans and I love America. I have some wonderful, wonderful friends I love in America. I love being in America. I've spent a lot of my life in the United States. I really like American people. The differences between Americans and Canadians, I really like. I believe you Americans are more patriotic. You're prepared to accept less in troubled times. I think Canadians are more entitled. But the sentiment to talk about Canada in general, it's somewhere, Jim, between 2/3 and 90% of people that are very upset. Now, you know, what's the truth? We should be upset with ourselves and our leaders. And our leaders are handling your President Trump, in my opinion, absolutely the wrong way. You don't poke a powerful bear like that, especially the way Mr. Trump is. You know, they could have done so much better. We've been the best friends in the world's history as neighboring countries. There's been no two better friends than Canada and America. And that's the way I feel. I wish I could have an hour lunch with President Trump. I'd kid him about beating you guys in the War of 1812, but we don't want to fight anymore now. We just have a couple of canoes and a bow and arrow up here in Canada. So we don't want to fight. We need America. But we got to start paying our way, Jim. I mean, Canadians, I think, are conveniently forgetting that we've been delinquent on our NATO duties for, I believe, over 30 years since Trudeau Sr. was around. And consistently delinquent of ships, personnel, and cash. So, you know, if I was an American, I might be upset that I was paying for Canada's, largely paying for Canada's defense. I mean, if war broke out, we need you. There's no question about that. Since we've scrapped most of our Navy and just have frigates, we apparently cannot defend our own coastlines. So, you know, there's two sides to every story. The border, I don't think the border is as much of an issue as has been said. Because you guys, Americans, have great border agents, very smart, experienced people on the borders. The southern border, President Trump finally looked after, and that was great. If I was American, I would think that was great anyway. But yes, the sentiment's very bad. People are selling their condos and homes in Florida, not going to Florida now, Canadians. I wish I was there right now. It's still cool up here. You know, it was 4 degrees this morning. It's supposed to warm up this week. We get into the high 40s and 50s. But I wish I was there. So, hey, you know, our premier of Ontario, who's been pretty popular, Doug Ford, he went down and threatened President Trump that he would cut the electric power off to the United States. We send a lot of electricity from Ontario and Quebec. And that was the wrong move. He got sent back home with his tail between his legs. And the two guys running for leader, the two serious contenders, the one I really don't like, he he says that he has said that the relationship between Canada and the United States is now changed forever. The old relationship is gone. You know, that's, I don't want to think that way. So it's a very strange situation, Jim, the whole thing. And I think certainly the majority of Canadians are against President Trump. You know, I recognize some of the good things that he accomplished in his first term, and he's sure looking after that border. It's hard for me to believe that was ignored pretty much by the previous administration. But yeah, by and large, you know, it's I don't think it's good. I'm wondering what Americans are thinking, what American people are thinking. I mean, with most of my friends, there's been no difference, of course, but. Like, are American people getting annoyed that Canada hasn't pulled its end? What do you think?
You know, I don't think that most Americans even know the issue exists, because most Americans are just so poorly informed. And so I think that that's pretty low on the list. We just want, you know, the tariffs to be equal. And I think that, you know, that's hard to defend in the other way. It's hard to attack equal as unfair.
That's right.
And so
that's right.
I would like to get to that status. I do believe that NATO and Canada should be paying for their self-defense. I do find that, you know, pretty insulting that we have to pay for it as Americans, but that's true in a lot of cases. We also have to pay higher medical and drug costs because we're paying for the creativity and the ingenuity to create those drugs in the first place. And then the rest of the world gets them very cheaply after we've paid for them.
That's so, right.
That happens in a lot of cases. But, you know, we are the big bully, and so we have to sort of accept some of the downside as well. So.
Well, but I agree with you, you know, and what was worse, it was like nails on a chalkboard to me, Jim. The 21 delinquent countries, there's 21 including Canada. Now, we're supposed to be a wealthy country. Turns out we owe as much per capita as you Americans do, only we don't have the defense responsibilities and size and so forth that America has maintained, of course, and that's very expensive. But, yeah, this notion that, so anyway, the 21 delinquent countries were kind of brought up on the carpet by President Trump over not meeting NATO obligations, and all 21 agreed that we would in 2025. And then a month later, just before resigning, Prime Minister Trudeau said, well, we'll be till 2032. Jim, it's 7 years. I mean, I don't even know what to say about that. Now the new guys running say that we will within 2 years. I can't believe what a mess we've got ourselves in up here in Canada. And yet we still give a ton of money away. When President Trump cut off the outfit called US Aid, Trudeau stepped right in his place and sent the $216 million. Well, first of all, we're not America. There's only 10% of us as many as Americans. So if you look at it this way, it cost us citizens 10 times as much per person as it would have cost America to send that money. And who the hell do we think we are that we can step in America's place for anything? And that's just the straight goods, Jim. I'm not trying to knock Canada, but geez, yeah, I'm not sending the Pee Wee baseball team out to play the Los Angeles Dodgers either. It would be ridiculous. So I'm upset about the whole thing, of course. Just the whole thing. But I guess I'm more upset with Canada and what we've opened ourselves up to. If we'd have met our obligations, I suppose, we wouldn't be on this hit list. And I agree with you on the tariff too, Jim. It seems only fair. I mean, China's been dumping their stuff on us all. The 53% of the world's manufacturing is done in China now, so very, very tough to turn that one around. But I'll tell you one thing that I respect about your president. This guy is so tenacious that personally, I'm glad he is in the position just now, because I think while there are no good nicks in the world, the communist leaders and China and Russia, and they're going to behave a little better with President Trump there, is what I believe.
I think so, too. I think that people are slower to do anything because he's crazy, they think, and they have no idea how he will respond. He could blow something up. You never know. He is crazy, I think. I think the craziness works in his benefit in that situation.
Well, he doesn't take a back seat to anybody, Jim. He doesn't like to be wrong. He doesn't like to fail. And what he's been through in these last years, the one thing I feel is that he's the toughest man on the planet. This is the most tenacious man on the planet. And personally, I like that America has the toughest guy on the earth leading them. You know, regardless of politics and all of the other items, just, you know, on that item alone, Jim, it's good to have a strong man in that office, I think.
I would certainly agree. But those are your opinions. Wayne, what about the average Canadian? The average Canadian's not as generous as you.
No, the average Canadian's offended terribly by President Trump. The notion of us being a 51st state is just really, really offended people. Like our sovereignty doesn't matter and so forth. The average Canadian does not want to look at both sides of the story. You know, we're delinquent. Well, wait a minute. Hold on. It doesn't sound like much when you say it fast, but if you add up what America's had to pay for the delinquent countries, holy doodle. I imagine it's a lot of money, Jim. I don't know what it is, but it's got to be a ton of money. And ships and personnel. Geez, you guys got more soldiers in Korea than I'm sure we have in all the armed forces put together. I believe that.
And so, we have 56,000 stationed in Korea, I believe.
Wow. Well, they all get paid every week, and those soldiers do, and get provisioned and so forth. So, I mean, it's just a tremendous cost to America to defend the free world. It's just tremendous. Must be trillions. And so, I think President Trump he could have eased these things in, but I think that was part of his plan to shock everyone, Jim, get everyone's attention that he's not fooling around here. And I just hope that we end up settling on something where we stay best friends. It'd break my heart if somebody told me I couldn't go to America again, or, you know, we're enemies or any of that kind of nonsense. I could never go there. I know too many of you.
What has happened with your ex-employee who used to work for Tesla and was dismissed very quickly after getting there?
He's been bouncing around doing a little of this, a little of that. He's on a retainer with one firm. And, I keep trying to come up with ideas where we could join forces again. So I got a couple of ideas. I think the world of this young fella and his family. And, but yeah, he'll always land on his feet. The best always do, Jim. You know, the best always do. I'm sure he could have a lot of jobs tomorrow. He's at a stage where he wants to make sure it's right for him. He had banked pretty heavily on Tesla, and thank goodness didn't move his family down to Reno, Nevada, but was glad for the experience. I guess it was pretty different, Jim.
I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
I saw the rocket, the Tesla, Elon Musk company, SpaceX, the hotel I was in on South Padre Island, the rocket launch is about 5 miles away, maybe less. So I saw that, and I just couldn't believe when it went out of sight, I turned away from the window. I'd been filming it with my telephone camera. And so I turned away when it went out of sight, and about a minute later exploded. And that's the loudest thing I ever heard. It shook the hotel. It was hundreds of miles away by then, Jim. And they say some of the shrapnel and so forth landed off the Keys and that in Florida. But it's the loudest noise I ever heard. It shook the hotel. I thought it might break the windows. And a lawyer in Brownsville is doing a class action suit for all the windows in the town that got broke and foundations cracked. And that was something. That was really something to see that and to hear that. I mean, that was, I was expecting stuff to rain down on us there, you know, because the rocket seemed to go straight up. And that explosion, boy, oh boy, was pretty crazy. But he's done some amazing things. I'm amazed where the rockets come back to Earth and go back to the launching pad and get grabbed by the arms. I mean, that's something else, this technology, isn't it?
Yes, and that technology makes Jeff Bezos, you know, he did the all-women flight a couple of days ago, and they still come down by parachutes. And yes, the fact that he's still using parachutes when SpaceX is catching the returning rocket with the chopsticks doesn't make Bezos look very good.
So. No, that's quite a, and this, I guess Musk has had his trouble, Elon Musk in the United States, since he's been the head of this Doge. And now there's an example. I thought it went a little bit too far. I saw a video of him with a chainsaw waving it through the air.
Yes, that was
solid. And that impression, you know, just, I would have said, isn't the right impression. You know, you sit down and talk about the tremendous waste that you're going to try and cut back. But that, I think that upset people as well. You're worrying that, you know, you're going to hack off limbs, you know. So, very interesting. What do you think? I think he's just about finished his job, isn't he?
Yes, and I don't think that they want him much more. I think that they've gotten the value out of him, and they'll get rid of him soon. I'm very sure. So,
I wouldn't be surprised. But there's seems to be a lot of, at least the press is reporting a lot of turmoil with your defense minister, that younger man, Exif, I think's his name. And so the fight goes on. Politics, Jim, is just the dirtiest game around. They talk about criminals, but by geez, I think politics tops the list of shenanigans and, you know, mudslinging and lying and cheating and, you know, you name it. They'll say anything to get elected. Same in Canada.
Yep.
Wait, what's rare is that they follow through and do what they promised they'd do, Jim. That's what's not so common.
Yeah, that's true. Just constant lying. Wayne, we need to wrap it up. Thank you again for your time, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Jim. God bless.
We are out of time for today, but you know what we do. That's right. We come back. Be safe. Take care. Bye now.